Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Academy of Florida Elder Law Attorneys. Florida's advocates for seniors and persons with disabilities. Academy of Florida Elder Law Attorneys. More information about AFELA's policies at afela.org. And from the United Faculty of Florida, representing over 20,000 faculty and graduate assistants at 13 universities and 14 colleges, working to encourage lawmakers to fund Florida's future through support of public education. Online at myuff.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Agency head confirmations in the Florida Senate are usually pretty sedate affairs. Mary Mayhew's wasn't.
Did I oppose Medicaid expansion in Maine? Yes.
Also tonight, fireworks likewise flare over a bill that would implement Amendment 4, which grants most felons the right to vote.
See, they weren't told that Barbara Pariente in open court suggested that it would be a good thing for the state if there was an incentive to buy your voting rights back.
We'll also hear about a confirmation hearing that didn't raise much sand at all today, and follow the progress of Florida's fetal heartbeat bill that would greatly restrict abortion in the state. I'm Tom Flanagan. Just one more day to go in the fifth week of this nine-week Florida legislative session. Welcome to Capitol Report. Governor Ron DeSantis's pick to head the Agency for Healthcare Administration, Mary Mayhew, passed her first Senate confirmation hearing today. Ryan Daly reports Mayhew briefly oversaw Medicaid for the Trump administration and was over the program in Maine for 7 years prior. Some senators grilled Mayhew on her noted opposition to Medicaid.
Your opposition to expanding Medicaid is well known.
Democratic Senator Kevin Rader was aggressive in his line of inquiry during the Appropriations Subcommittee on Health and Human Services meeting.
In Maine, when voters passed through a voter initiative, and I think it was 2016 or 17, Medicaid expansion through a ballot initiative, you supported the governor there, and if I mispronounce his name, I'm sorry, LePage, determination to prevent disimplementation. If Medicaid expansion is on the ballot next year in the state of Florida or in subsequent years, and voters endorse it and vote for it, would you continue your activism here to prevent that implementation?
During a tense exchange with Rader, Mayhew at first seemed to deflect.
First of all, Senator, again, I had stepped down before that was passed at the ballot, so I was not working in the administration when the governor was protesting the implementation of that law.
Were you there when the legislature passed it?
Let me just finish, though. But I am responsible for implementing the laws that are passed. I am here in Maine to serve the governor of the state, to serve the people of the state, and to be responsible to the legislature for the implementation of laws.
But Mayhew did eventually level with the Boca Raton Democrat about why she has long taken a stance against Medicaid expansion.
Did I oppose Medicaid expansion in Maine? Yes. Maine had expanded long before the Affordable Care Act, and we were hemorrhaging red ink.
Another Democratic senator, Daryl Rouson, asked Mayhew about reports that the agency she now heads is pushing cuts to reimbursement rates for providers who treat children with autism. Rouson noted that he and his wife have a child who is autistic.
It was brought to my attention that ACA has proposed up to 54% cuts in rates, and it seems to me that that might be just a little bit insensitive at this time. Can you explain that?
So first, Senator, let me say that we are no longer going forward at this time with those rate changes and rate reductions.
Mayhew says following a public information meeting she sat in on last week and reviewing feedback, AHCA made the decision to not move forward with the rate changes in the last couple days before the confirmation hearing. Senator Rader's line of questioning included Mayhew's history at the Maine Department of Health and Human Services. He brought up a report from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services that scrutinized whether a Maine Medicaid waiver program complied with state and federal regulations. The program served beneficiaries with developmental disabilities.
There were 133 deaths in the OIG report that it looked at and found that 9 of the 133 deaths were unexplained, suspicious, and untimely. And for another 32 deaths, the state could not provide enough information for the Office of the Inspector General to make a determination.
That program was serving about 2,600 beneficiaries in Maine. Rader says Florida's equivalent program serves tens of thousands.
Ultimately, the Office of Inspector General conducted that the state could not show that it had a system to ensure the health, welfare, and safety of the 2,640 Medicaid beneficiaries with developmental disabilities covered by the Medicaid waiver. Did you find that there were systematic problems with Maine's program?
Mayhew told Rader the report did expose some flaws to the system she formerly oversaw.
All of the deaths were, in fact, investigated by the Attorney General's office. There is a panel in Maine that reviews every death. None of the deaths were as a result of abuse and neglect. It still, however, pointed out that the agency was not timely investigating. So there were many issues that needed to be addressed.
Committee feedback on the DeSantis-AHCA secretary pick wasn't all negative. Several senators, like Republican Anatiri Flores, commended Mayhew for being accessible.
You're the first person in a long time that we give an issue to, and within 24 to 48 hours, our office has a response.
Though the majority Republican committee pushed Mayhew through on the first confirmation hearing, Senator Rader had some harsh words.
This is really one of the worst confirmations of someone that I can imagine in the United States.
Mayhew's second of three confirmation hearings will take place in the Senate Health Policy Committee next week. I'm Ryan Daly.
When voters approve amendments to Florida's Constitution, they sometimes have to pass legislation that would actually implement the change. This session, lawmakers are attempting to implement last year's Amendment 4 that allows certain felons the right to vote after completing their sentences. But some insist the amendment is self-enacting and therefore requires no implementing legislation. Both sides in that argument squared off during today's bill hearing. Blaise Gainey fills us in.
Tampa Republican Representative James Grant says when determining the voters' intent of Amendment 4, he believes the legislature has only two options.
Members, it's a binary choice. Either we choose to assume that voters relied on the testimony made in open court to the world. Either we choose to believe that voters could rely on the frequently asked question that clearly and unambiguously stipulated what the terms of the sentence meant, or we're going to pull the rug out from underneath them.
What Grant is talking about is the advisory hearing held by the Florida Supreme Court. During this meeting, Florida Rights Restoration Coalition attorney John Mills defined completion of sentence.
It specifically includes all matters included in the sentence, including probation and parole. So that means all matters, anything that a judge puts in a sentence.
So it would also include the full payment of any fines?
Yes, sir.
In response, Brian Pitts, a common public commenter, says he agrees with Grant.
They were trying to make a self-executing with language that was not set. The only way to do that from a ballot is define the terms in the ballot. That's what he did with the Miracle Marijuana ballot. That's why you're locked into that. You're not locked into this. So I'm sorry, I very rarely agree, but you're going to have to go with Grant, with Representative Grant on this.
St. Petersburg's Democratic Representative Wingay Newton agrees, but he also thinks the will of the voters should be what the legislature enacts.
And I heard Mr. Pitts, if it was a glitch, and it's up to us as a legislature to make sure we fix that and give the people the right and put forward the will of the voters.
But what's the voters' intent? And how do you find that out from more than 5 million people? Riverview Democratic Representative Adam Hattersley says they've told him.
Every constituent that I've spoken to shares a similar sentiment, that they voted based on what was on the ballot, not was testified before the Supreme Court or on a website. It's been said in committee that it's not our purview to speculate as to what the will of the voters was, but I've yet to speak to a single voter who feels that it was their intent to require returning citizens to pay fines and fees that were not assigned by a judge as part of their sentence.
The fees and fines Hattersley speaks of are the medical costs and transportation costs. These aren't on the sentencing document when the judge sentences a felon, but are added on later by the Department of Corrections. Hattersley says making felons pay back these fines before they can vote creates a caste system.
There'd be a minority of well-off individuals who would be able to repay their fines quickly and regain their right to vote. Then there'd be indigent citizens who already face great challenges reintegrating into civilian life. We've heard from that as well.
Hattersley is talking about people like Erica Rax, a felon who thought she was going to get her right to vote back. She says now she'll never be able to.
Now the fact that I may have a right to vote now is going to be taken away because I cannot afford $57,000 being a single mother, being a convicted felon where I cannot go to school without paying out of pocket. I cannot use the degree that I earned before I went to prison. I can't even pay those student loans back. And you want me to pay the government $57,000 to vote? I have no control over my daughter's future. I have no control over her health care. I have no control over her education. I would love to have some control over her future. Money should not make me a person. My felony should not stop me from my future, from my child's future, from any of this.
Bill sponsor Representative James Grant says he believes the system is not a great one, but that the bill and amendment does not ask for that.
Who I feel the worst for in this exercise is the people who volunteered, the people who went and got petitions signed, the people who were told that if this passes, you'll have your voting rights back. See, they weren't told that Barbara Perriente, in open court, suggested that it would be a good thing for the state if there was an incentive to buy your voting rights back.
The bill now heads to the House Judiciary Committee. The Senate version is scheduled to be heard in the Senate Judiciary Committee Monday. I'm Blaze Gaynor.
Still to come on Capitol Report, Florida lawmakers move closer to passing fetal heartbeat bills.
When they can actually see a heart beating and they can actually visualize that this is their child.
And a Florida university is pioneering a new treatment for military vets and others affected by post-traumatic stress syndrome.
So as a therapist, while I'll be looking for signs of physical arousal, shaking, teary-eyed, you know, muscle tension, those type of things.
Support for Capital Report is provided by The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
14 states, including Florida, are currently considering fetal heartbeat bills. Those bills ban abortion after a fetal heartbeat can be detected. WMFE's Danielle Pryor reports women, healthcare providers, and pregnancy crisis centers are divided when it comes to the legislation.
Kristen Erickson was in high school and homeless when she found out she was in her first trimester.
My mom and I had been evicted 3 times already that year. She didn't have a job. I was too young to get a job.
Around the same time, Seleshka Acevedo, a young wife and mother, found out she was in her second.
My husband at the time, he was laid off of work, and I was the only one that was working, taking care of our 2 children at the time.
Both pregnancies were unplanned, and both women knew they wouldn't be able to parent. Kristen Erickson and Seleshka Acevedo were considering abortions. Florida law requires health providers perform an ultrasound before they can terminate a pregnancy. Erickson went to Planned Parenthood for her ultrasound.
I mean, seeing an ultrasound didn't change any of the circumstances in my life that made it impossible for me to be a parent.
Acevedo went to the Pregnancy Crisis Center Options for Women for hers.
Seeing it move around and you could see the head, the body, the legs, you know, the arms, everything. So just seeing it move around, I'm like, I had to really decide whether or not if I was going to parent or if adoption was an option.
Both women decided to look at the ultrasound photos, but made different decisions. Erickson chose abortion, and Acevedo chose adoption. If a fetal heartbeat bill introduced by Republican Senator Dennis Baxley and Republican Representative Mike Hill becomes law, it would take away one of these options. Once a heartbeat is detected, the woman would have to carry a pregnancy to term, unless it threatens her life or she's the victim of rape or incest. Dr. Virgil Reed runs an ultrasound machine at Planned Parenthood in Orlando, where he's the medical director. The clinic offers women reproductive health care, including abortions. Reed doesn't think knowing there's a fetal heartbeat would change patients' minds.
I don't think that it will have a significant impact on the actual number of pregnancy terminations that happen in the state. It's a shocking degree of government overreach.
But Reed says the bill would make it harder for patients to get an abortion. He says a fetal heartbeat develops around the sixth week. That's before most women even know they're pregnant.
Smile, so cute. Does she sleep pretty well for you, or?
She does.
Across town, a volunteer at JMJ Pregnancy Center talks to a mom and baby. Women's rights advocates say pregnancy crisis centers intentionally mislead women into thinking they perform abortions in order to counsel them against it. But JMJ makes it clear it does not terminate pregnancies. It does provide ultrasounds along with counseling and baby clothes and formula. Director Marianne O'Shea says ultrasounds do change women's minds.
It becomes a baby when they can actually see a heart beating, and they can actually visualize that this is their child.
No fetal heartbeat bill has become law yet, but a conservative state Supreme Court and support from the legislature and Governor Ron DeSantis could change this. That's why Christian Erickson and Seleska Acevedo are following the bills closely. Their opinions about abortion might be different, but they both want to see more support for women in similar situations. Erickson wants to make it easier to prevent unplanned pregnancies.
Getting rid of abstinence-only education, making birth control and contraceptives available to everyone for free.
While Acevedo wants more women who can't parent to consider adoption.
If they understood more about adoption and the resources that are available to them, I feel like that also plays a huge role.
Danielle Pryor.
A bill to exempt diaper purchases from state sales taxes is once again moving in the Senate. Regan McCarthy has that.
Plantation Democratic Senator Lauren Book says purchasing diapers can be a major expense for low-income families and seniors.
Diapers are a major expense for any household with young children or adults with incontinence issues, running in excess of $75 a month on the average. For some families, this is just another piece of their monthly budget. But 49% of Florida's children under the age of 3 live in low-income families, as do 10% of Florida's elders. And for these families, the cost of diapers can present impossible choices.
Book says families can be left to choose between paying their utility bill or buying diapers. She says for low-income single parents, diapers take up a disproportionate amount of a family's income, in some cases up to 14%.
Families living in poverty tend to make diapers last a little bit longer by changing them less frequently, which can be more than uncomfortable. It's unhealthy. Leaving a child or an adult in a diaper for too long can cause severe dermatitis, urinary infections, and other health conditions.
Currently, 15 other states have a sales tax carve-out for diapers. West Palm Beach Democratic Senator Bobby Powell says he'd like to see Florida join them.
There's newspaper articles where a child wearing a diaper for extremely long periods of time has resulted in children being in the hospital, in emergency rooms, and in extreme cases, a potential death. As a person who has a small child, myself, as do you, I'm a frequent diaper changer. and I think it's just necessary that we do so. But I fortunately don't fall into the category where some people would, because both me and my wife are working. However, it's important that we look out for our most vulnerable populations.
Ocala Republican Senator Dennis Baxley says there are other options for families struggling to buy diapers.
Of course, I go back when we had cloth diapers and washed them and trained them to walk or to go to use the bathroom by the time they're 8 months, so we don't have to buy diapers or wash diapers. there are strategies at work, but at the same time, I think this has become the standard of an acceptable sanitary way to deal with these settings.
Baxley says he supports the idea of a targeted tax reduction.
I think it's a great place to start, and I'm always interested in a tax cut. This is their money. We take money from them when they're buying essentials, and we don't do that for food or medicine. And this has become really an essential.
The bill has one committee stop left to go in the Senate. It has no companion in the House. I'm Regan McCarthy.
If Mary Mayhew, who we heard about earlier, got a lot of pushback during her confirmation hearing in the Florida Senate today, the guy who'd like to be the state's new prison chief got nary a peep of protest. Florida senators are signaling their support for Department of Corrections Secretary Mark Inch. He was appointed by Governor Ron DeSantis. Lynn Hatter reports Inch says he wants to shore up the prison system's mental health treatment programs and infrastructure.
Republican Senator Jeff Brandis calls Inch the right man at the right time.
I've come to believe that the legislature needs you. And so I'm somebody who believes God puts people in the right place at the right time. And I know a series of circumstances have led you to be here.
Florida's prison system has struggled in recent years with high staff turnover, low morale, and shrinking budgets. Hurricanes Michael and Irma caused critical infrastructure damage to some facilities, and others are getting old. There are problems with contraband, surging health care costs, and management of one of the largest prison populations in the country. Enter Mark Inch.
I am a 35-year military veteran. I first led what would be the equivalent of a county jail in 1986. I was the warden of the Department of Defense's only maximum security prison, and then later ran our entire system.
Inch comes from President Donald Trump's administration. Former U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions named Inch to head the Federal Bureau of Prisons in 2017. DeSantis tapped Inch to come to Florida when DeSantis became governor. Inch says he wants to take what he calls a holistic approach to the job.
That we serve to incapacitate those that have chosen a criminal path, and frankly, those who continue to choose a criminal path, being able to incapacitate to protect public. And for those who could be deterred from crime to serve as a deterrent. But I also think we reflect what's best in our society, that for those who have offended society through their criminal behavior, that we take efforts to rehabilitate and with intent restore to society.
Inch says Florida is poised to become a leader in corrections. Democratic Senator Daryl Roussan wants to know what it will take to make that happen.
Name one or two things that you feel your talents would help FDC become a leader nationally?
Thank you, Senator, for that question. I think it starts with getting back to basics of the purpose of the correction system. So that's how you've heard me speak, that when we look at innovation in both the side of incapacitation, running safe and secure prisons, doing those actions to interdict contraband, to minimize criminal behavior inside the prisons, we have to focus on that. And that comes with our discussion on proper staffing, proper use of technology, proper use of procedures. So we will certainly focus on that.
Inch also says Florida can lead by shoring up its training and vocational programs and ministry programs. All have been dealt budget cuts in recent years. The testimony won over the Senate's Criminal Justice Appropriations Committee, which gave Inch's appointment a unanimous backing. It comes as the legislature as a whole is considering bills to address the problems Inch has highlighted. One would lower the age of correctional officers from 19 to 18. Another deals with the use of drones by outsiders to drop contraband into prisons. I'm Lynn Hatter.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, a clinic at the University of Central Florida is using virtual reality to treat veterans and active service members with post-traumatic stress disorder. As WUSF Health News Florida's Stephanie Colombini tells us, the military is funding efforts to expand the therapy to more patients.
Imagine you're walking through a village in a war zone in Iraq. Suddenly, a bomb explodes. Guns are firing. Children are crying. The distinct smells of diesel fuel and burning flesh waft through the air as the ground rumbles beneath your feet. It
It's all very disturbing. Except this isn't an Iraqi village. It's a therapist's office at the University of Central Florida. The clinic UCF Restores has been using virtual reality as part of an exposure therapy program to treat PTSD in combat veterans since 2010. Deborah Bidell's the clinic director. She says many patients struggle with everyday tasks like shopping or going to the gas station.
We never think that people's traumatic memories are going to go away. But what we want to do is dislocate those triggers from the anxiety. So from now on, a person could smell diesel fuel and not worry that an IED is going to explode and their best friend is going to be killed.
38-year-old Kevin Turgliaferra from Polk County is an Army National Guard veteran and served in Afghanistan. He's battled anger and manic depression and says it was damaging his relationship with his family.
Where I'd get aggravated with the kids, or I wouldn't want to engage with the kids because I'm too on edge when we go somewhere. Anything outside my little comfort zone was a no-go.
Turgliaferra participated in UCF's three-week intensive treatment program. Every day, he put on virtual reality goggles and watched scenes that reflected his personal experience. Besides visuals, therapist Keith Smith also uses sounds and scents. There's even a platform under the chair that vibrates.
We tell the patients initially that this is going to be a very uncomfortable process. So as a therapist, while I'll be looking for signs of physical arousal, shaking, teary-eyed, you know, muscle tension, those type of things.
Smith says patients get calmer with each session and reveal more details about their trauma. Turgliaferra says he was shocked to see himself open up.
The layers, they just peel back and they get you to your core. It's like, really? Come on, you know? At first, it's like you don't want to, but you break down and do it, and it's absolutely amazing.
With funding from the Department of Defense, the clinic is now expanding its services to three military bases in the Southeast to treat more active duty personnel. It's also developing new software that can create more scenarios to fit patients' personal experiences. Bidell cites a Marine who came to the clinic and struggled to respond to a scene that had men wearing Army uniforms.
It's distracting because I keep looking at that guy next to me and going, that's the wrong uniform. So we have to get to that level of detail, and our new VR tool will allow us to do that.
The software will also include scenes to treat first responders and survivors of mass shootings. For Health News Florida, I'm Stephanie Colombini.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Sean Mulcahy. Thanks also to Danielle Pryor and Stephanie Colombini. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Be sure to join us again every weeknight throughout the Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Academy of Florida Elder Law Attorneys. Florida's advocates for seniors and persons with disabilities. Academy of Florida Elder Law Attorneys. More information about AFELA's policies at afela.org. And from the United Faculty of Florida, representing over 20,000 faculty, staff professionals, and graduate assistants at 13 universities and 14 colleges. Advocates for quality higher education for all Floridians. Online at myuff.org.